Hey everybody, welcome again to another edition of the Tradescast, a podcast dedicated to all things business entertainment. I'm Jeff Favre.
And I am Michael Patterson, and welcome to the Tradescast for July 11th, 2010.
Yeah, if you were with us last week, it was a special holiday week. We talked a lot of premium channel original programming. We've got a lot of good feedback from that. I hope it stirred some of your memories, and if you didn't listen to it, go back and listen to it in our archives. There's a lot of movie action going on the past couple of weekends, and we're going to get to the box office in a minute, but maybe you may have missed this. They have been looking for this person for quite some time, and there's been a lot of back and forth, even some controversy, but it looks like we've got ourselves a new Spidey. What do you think, Mike?
Well, you know, I think like everybody else, I was like, who the heck is Andrew Garfield? Now, of course, a bit of that is because they've decided over at Sony and the powers that be that they're going to go young and they're going to go cheap. And so this is who they came up with. Now, I know he's in the upcoming David Fincher movie, The Social Network, which is also known as the Facebook movie. But I know very little else about him. Do you know anything about him?
No, he's done very, very little. I keep joking about different things we've discussed. I call it the Johnny Bravo effect from the Brady Bunch, where Greg was Johnny Bravo, anybody who fit the suit. And we're going to have to see if that's where the Spider-Man franchise currently is, whoever can fit the suit. Because if you're old enough, and you don't have to be that old to remember, Batman looked invincible for a while. After Michael Keaton left, it looked like whoever got in the Batman suit, it was still going to do well. And you know what they figured out eventually was the movie started getting bad and people didn't want to go anymore. So Batman had to take a little nap for about a decade.
Right.
So We're going to have to see if Andrew Garfield, if it matters whether Andrew Garfield's even any good, or if Mark Webb, who is taking over from Sam Raimi directing, will have the knack for Spider-Man. I know special effects continue to get better, but simply because the previous three movies have done incredibly well, it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to be in love with Spider-Man forever. I don't know. I mean, he seems fine. I keep hearing great things about Andrew Garfield. Mark Webb is a skilled director. But do you think that this reboot, this return to, first of all, he's 26 years old, but putting him back in high school, you think this is a good idea?
Boy, you know, the tough thing is that with all these comic book characters and comic book stories, there's always this inclination to go back to origin stories. And I don't want to see that anymore. Now, the amazing thing is that there is probably some 12, 13-year-old kids out there that don't know the Spider-Man origin. And those are the people that are going to wind up paying for these tickets. So there's very much a double-edged sword, because obviously they're going back to this moment in time where they're going to wind up telling some sort of origin story, whether it's a quick one or not a quick one. And for people like us, we've gone through this now a couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of more, maybe at least a couple of times. But I think you're on the right track with what you said before, which was going cheap. When Spider-Man 3 came out, it was the most expensive movie ever made. I believe it was $250 to $300 million, and they made their money back. I mean, I'm sure they would like to say they didn't, but we know they did. So if they can go a little cheaper, then why not? I mean, I think they ought to play it a little bit conservative. I think that it probably will do well, because I think they're still in that world of whoever can fit the suit. But I would not count on Spider-Man being another trilogy of big budget movies. Although, who knows? Competition for these kind of movies is not that great. I mean, how many franchises do we have going on? The X-Men have kind of petered out, even though Wolverine did pretty well. And Iron Man, I don't know how many more they're going to do. So,
well,
you know,
unfortunately, there's a lot of them, because they're coming out with Captain America, and we're going to have the Avengers. I'm assuming eventually we'll have another Iron Man movie. I don't know what's going to happen with Batman, but you know, we're going through a couple of these here. There's, believe it or not, there's a lot of comic book movies in the future here, and I don't know, you know, how creative they're actually thinking about these things. I think that with Sony saying they were going to go cheap and they were going to go young, that was interesting. But I see also the money play that they're going after. Obviously, cheap is just cheap. But they're actually looking at possibly trying to Twilightify this movie.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Although it is funny because he is 26 years old.
Yeah.
So, but I know what you're meaning. I mean, Tobey Maguire was 26 when Spider-Man started. Right. So, but you're right. It is crowded. What I guess I meant is there room for all of these? And we're going to see as your Thors and your Captain Americas and your lesser heroes start getting their own movies. We'll see how well they do. But it's going to be fascinating. The Spider-Man movie comes out. It'll be, don't worry, gang, it's going to be in 3D. but it's going to be out in 2012 in case you wanted to start standing in line now. I don't know when, just as in passing, I don't know when the next Pee-wee Herman movie is going to come out, but I'm kind of excited that it's going to. Judd Apatow's been rumored to be part of developing the new Pee-wee Herman feature. I saw his new live show, and I got to tell you, it looks a lot like the old show. And if you like the old show, that's great. Although Paul Rubens, I don't know how he looks. I don't know how he looks as young as he does. Maybe it's because I didn't get very close, but he's almost 60. So they better hurry up with that movie if they're gonna do it. But I'm excited about that. But we got to get to the box office because we have missed a couple of weeks here. And even though it's not number one right now, Eclipse really proved itself to have incredibly rabid fans. I mean, they were breaking all kinds of records, midnight records, first day records, second day records. They really, by the time the first 4 or 5 days was over, they were already looking at astronomical numbers.
Yeah, I was really actually quite interested in seeing how gangbusters this was going to be, like what the actual force of box office. The one number that I do love, just because it's kind of funny and geeky, is the midnight number. It broke the midnight box office number. Now, that takes a special type of person. And of course,
crazy. It takes a crazy person.
But you know, the George Lucas fans were the ones that really were into that. And also the Lord of the Ring types, you know, and there's so much to that, which seems to scream a bit more adult. Whereas these Twilight movies, they're not, you know, big age group. You know, there's, once you hit 30, it really starts to dwindle, to be honest with you. Although I have heard that there's a lot of, you know, mothers out there that secretly love
a lot them. Of lonely. There's a lot of lonely women go.
But also, having seen the crowd at the premiere for Eclipse, I just didn't see how some of these late night numbers and everything would be so huge, but obviously it just trampled everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure if you saw the premiere crowd, I'm sure there was a lot dressed like vampires, and you know, it's so cool to be a vampire these days. And I guess if you got vampires and werewolves in the same movie, but I'm still blown away by the Twilight, how the phenomenon and how big it is. But you got to look at it. It's kind of interesting. As big as it did, it couldn't win 2 weeks in a row. And I got to tell you, it's probably because I have not seen a more forceful ad campaign for a movie I didn't know crap about than Despicable Me. Those little freaking yellow characters have been on my NBC TV shows for about 6 months, talking to the Biggest Loser people, running around the Tonight Show. They're on commercials. These people must have made their money back before the movie ever even opened. But they forced America to go, and $60 million this weekend basically doubled the Twilight Saga film.
Yeah, I got to say, it is impressive. Although every time I see the Steve Carell character do his voice, I go, my God, is that not the worst accent ever? It drives me nuts. I'm like, wasn't there something, like, I know that there's something funny about a bad accent, but it actually really annoys me. So I'm having a hard time with that. Now, at least, you know, we didn't get the onslaught of little, predators in the corner of your TV for the last 6 months. But that movie also premiered this last week, and it seemed to do pretty good at like $25 million for its opening.
Oh, I think they got to be thrilled with this, because I can't believe it was already time for a reboot of Predators. I mean, we went straight from Predators and Aliens to Predators versus Aliens and Aliens versus Predators and Predators versus your mama. And all of a sudden, we're back at the original Predators again. So it's almost like they never went away. They've always been here. And $25 million is pretty good. I think they've got to be pleased with that. Probably not as pleased as The Last Airbender, people, with reviews that bad. For a film to already gross more than $100 million, but basically no critics liking it. I don't know what's going on with M. Night Shyamalan, but he seems to... Am I wrong? Has he lost his mind?
Well, it's funny, because I think he's one of these types of people that, just, like it or not, is surrounded too much by yes men. And, you know, from everything we've heard, you know, he's such an amazing director and got such great vision. But the thing is that, you know, film is a collaborative thing. And I think that everybody is too afraid to lose their paycheck. And boy, I tell you, I haven't actually looked at the Rotten Tomatoes meter this week, but I heard it was somewhere under 10% for this film.
It was. I think it's currently holding at 6.
Wow.
So, but yes, he definitely... You know, after The Sixth Sense, he was given unprecedented control, and then they didn't want to keep giving him control, and now, working with Paramount, he's getting a lot of control, and I think there's going to be a point, and it's going to be very, very soon, just like that day everyone woke up and realized Harrison Ford can't open a movie to save his life, unless his name is Indiana Jones. They're going to realize that M. Night Shyamalan just can't do it anymore. But... You know, the numbers that interested me in the box office, and there were a few. One is that Toy Story 3, as we predicted, the numbers are dropping slowly. And I picked it as the number one movie of the summer. It's at $340 million, which is looking really, really positive. A couple other numbers that are interesting to me. Night and Day is in the 60s, and it's not going to make $100 million. And Tom Cruise, with another film that's not going to make $100 million. Valkyrie came close, but it didn't make it. So those two. And then, as I predicted, the sleeper of the year, Karate Kid, at $164 million. I don't know how I knew that one was going to do well, but which of the numbers intrigued you the most?
Well, you know, there was just a happy thing when I did see the numbers this week to see that, you know, even though it's in such few theaters, Cyrus was able to stay in the top 10 for its second week. I think it's got over 2 million. Now, this movie probably has a budget of 10, so it's going to probably see a lot better performance, obviously, on home video. Besides that, I'm trying to think if there's, you know, I think we're at a normal place. I am surprised by the Karate Kid numbers, pleasantly surprised. That means people are going to the theaters, and, you know.
So you don't believe that we are in summer slump. The numbers are lower, but you're still feeling pretty good about the summer overall.
I'm feeling great. I'm a little surprised that people were that disconcerting about Day and Night and the A-Team, especially the A-Team, because that's such a guilty pleasure movie, obviously, but it just really didn't pack the punch that I think they were really hoping for. And we'll see, because next week for me is the big week.
Yeah, Mike,
week. This
is it, Mike. You've put all your chips on the line with next week.
Next week to me is basically either, you know, the last great hope for original programming in the summer, or I guess not originally programming, but original scripts that aren't tied to other properties versus this film that obviously is all tied up into the Disney world, but being sold to the masses as well. I really do hope that Inception does great numbers. I don't think it can do like, you know, Twilight numbers. I don't think it's going to be racking in $100 million, but I really do hope that it does, you know, far above The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, well, I know that you've really been counting on Inception. When we talked at the beginning of the summer of what movies to look out for, you've been talking Inception. Now, Christopher Nolan has had a pretty good track record, but obviously what we best know him for, or the world knows right. him for, is The Dark Knight. Now, he's written Inception, and I'm pretty fascinated by this, and he refused to do it in 3D, which I'm very pleased about. He's got Leonardo DiCaprio and Ellen Page, and I'm pleased about that as well. It's going to be fascinating to see if it does do big, because like you said, if it doesn't, then I honestly believe that in coming summers, you will not see many of these what we would call original ideas. You are going to be seeing sequels. You're going to be seeing Marvel properties. You're going to be seeing Disney properties. Now, The Sorcerer's Apprentice to me is one of those films where I won't be surprised either way. But when I heard they were making this live action feature based on a character from Fantasia, I thought, holy smokes, this is a bad idea. But of course, I thought it was a bad idea to do Pirates of the Caribbean. So I don't know. But all I know is that John Turteltaub and Nicolas yeah. Cage, that yeah. grouping, that pairing, they have a track record. So, you know, maybe it'll be huge.
You know, that's the funny thing is that obviously if you follow Hollywood logic, The Sorcerer's Apprentice should be a gangbuster movie. It's a property that is tied to a Disney concept, so it should have some kind of built-in box office. Plus, you have a star in Nicolas Cage and a director who has handled Nicolas Cage before doing really, you know, quality box office numbers. I wouldn't say that they're, you know, Twilight numbers, but they're very close. You know, it's amazing when you see these, you know, when you look at these historical pairing. I am praying that people go to Inception. Please, anybody within the sound of my voice, next weekend, go see this movie.
Well, it's going to be a pretty big weekend. I think you're right. I think Inception will do well. I'm hoping it will do big, but I think for sure it will do well. Despicable Me is going to hold up. Eclipse is going to hold up. Toy Story 3. So there are definitely, and then I think the wild card is Sorcerer's Apprentice, but don't be surprised if it does pretty big yeah. numbers. It's going to be fascinating. I can't wait to get to it. Oh, this reminds me. We got an email from Ken in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Ken emailed us at thetradescast@gmail.com. You can also, by the way, check us out at twitter.com/thetradescast, or you can call us. We love getting phone calls at 323-638-4763, or check us out on Facebook. Mike is fabulous and putting great updates on Facebook. You will learn a lot throughout the week. But Ken emailed us at thetradescast@gmail.com, and he said, I listened to the podcast last week, and I hear there's some kind of shakeup going on at Showtime. What's happening? So I thought we would just touch on that real quick, Mike. The Showtime Entertainment president, Robert Greenblatt, is going out. He's going to be replaced by David Nevins. But what I wanted Ken and other people to know is it doesn't sound like any kind of real shakeup in the sense of Greenblatt's done anything wrong. In fact, it's just the opposite. I think he's just finally chosen to step down after a lot of years, because Showtime in the last 7 years has grown substantially. They've grown from about 12 to 18 million subscribers, and they're getting closer and closer to HBO, and I think it's based on a lot of the shows that we talked about last week, such as Dexter, Weeds, Californication, and The Tudors. You got to look at Showtime's last 5 or 6 years as a real golden era for them so far.
Absolutely. And obviously, a lot of credit is due to Greenblatt. And it is interesting that, you know, usually this is not the case with, you know, broadcast executives. Usually they overstay their welcome and they kind of get pushed out the door. Although some people just seemingly can stay there forever, like Les Moonves or something like that. But he had an excellent run. I'm assuming that he'll be on to, I would not be surprised if there's some kind of CBS executive chair waiting for him, or maybe somewhere at a movie studio, because, you know, he was able to really, I mean, take what was already started, which, you know, last week we did talk about original programming in Showtime, and Showtime did have some original programming, but really took it, focused it, and got it on a track that has obviously really done well. And now actually HBO does have to look over its shoulder.
Yeah, very, very few misses in the last 6 or 7 years and a lot of hits. So it's great that Showtime has become a player on par with HBO, because it just means more good programming for us viewers, which I love. I don't know if you look at it as good news or bad news, but we missed it while we were doing our special broadcast, that Larry King has announced he will leave. His ratings have started to plummet. And of course he's having trouble with his, I believe, seventh marriage. And I'm still pretty sure he's been dead for 4 years, but Larry King is out after 25 years. I think it's probably time for him to go. And this is a story, Mike, that we'll have to follow up on, because we'll have to see who takes over the chair and the suspenders. I think it might be Ryan Seacrest, which is going to be weird. And I can't wait to see Ryan Seacrest when he's 75. but I don't know who it'll be. But will you miss Larry King at all? I mean, he is so oblivious all the time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because I definitely was one of those people that tended to watch CNN as my news program for a number of years. And I would obviously just, you know, depending on the guest, watch Larry King. But I think with a lot of other competition in the news category, 24-hour news, and just the fact that, you know, I didn't find his interviews that interesting, you know, in the last couple of years, I tuned out. And obviously a lot of other people have. CNN has a viewership problem right now. It went
seriously problem, yeah, because they won't take a side. I hate the fact that they seem to try to be – they tried to remain ethical. It didn't work. So basically, they just decided to start reading people's tweets and Facebook updates.
Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is that I understand where that, like, you know, that social networking thing does seem to have some significance to the news. But I don't know where they're going to stand. I don't know if they can turn themselves into, let's just say, a BBC. Where people say, like, oh, that is just where the news exists.
Right. You know, I mean, the fact that if I really want serious daily news, I'm going to go to PBS or BBC, and I'm probably not going to go to CNN anymore. But what's my alternative? I got people screaming at the right and the left. So, but anyway, Larry King is leaving. And I'll tell you, the one memory that I will never be able to shake from Larry King was on the anniversary of Elvis Presley's death a couple of years ago. He was at Graceland talking with Priscilla, and every time she tried to say something, he would interrupt with some of the most ridiculous things. Like, she was trying to talk about his music, and he said, so he died right over there in that bathroom, right? Over there, and he died in that bathroom? Okay, interesting. And she looked so embarrassed for him and for herself. So that's the Larry King I always will remember, the guy who seems to have no idea what he's talking about. He's just I found him to be very embarrassing, and I guess I think he won't be very missed. But,
you know, I wonder if in, you know, 20 years when he's, you know, dead and buried, that we don't miss somebody like him. I mean, there are a couple of people like him. Who's our friend that's over on PBS with just the
Hugh Hauser, baby?
Well, not Hugh Hauser, but the actual person that interviews at the table, Charlie Rose.
Oh,
you know, there's yeah. Charlie Rose. There's him. I don't know where there's other people that do the one-on-one in depth, and that is something that we're gonna have to see. You know, this Ryan Seacrest thing is kind of fascinating. You know, he might be the right guy for the job. I hate to think that, because I would like to hope to think that there's somebody out there that might be semi more cerebral. but like a Charlie Rose.
Well, I love Charlie Rose and Tavis Smiley, and if we ever lump Larry King in with those two guys 20, 30 years down the road, I hope you and I are healthy enough and sane enough to scream out, no, those are not the same people.
Well, sadly, I just did. So,
I was here to stop you. Now, here's the story, Mike, that I think a lot of people don't know about. It's been many years in the making, and it's a little complicated. I won't go into too much detail, but Disney has finally, now they're going to appeal, but they have finally lost a verdict about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and its distribution rights that is going to cost them, unless they get it overturned or they get the damages diminished, it's going to cost them $270 million.
Yeah, and this is an interesting court case on a number of levels, but I'm going to try to make this as simple as possible just to understand why this suit happened and the allegations and pretty much what we already know happens. They're trying to force the studio's hands to admit to this. Now, the way that the millionaire thing happened was that it was a property that was licensed by Walt Disney, the company, and a production company, which is owned by Walt Disney, was going to make it, and a distribution venture, which was ABC, was going to distribute it. Now, you see, all of these are owned by the same companies except for the idea, the concept. The allegation is that the people that owned the original concept should be getting a lot more money, that they haven't seen these royalty checks coming in over the years. And what, of course, Disney says is, well, we haven't made a profit. And, of course, on the books, they haven't. The reason why that is they overpay the people that are in these other companies that they own.
Right. They're paying themselves more to play with the books. We call it Hollywood accounting. Right. And we have discussed it on this podcast several times. According to every studio, no movie they've ever made has ever made money, never made a dime, because they're trying to make these things turn out to zero. It works in their Absolutely. Favor. But for once, a jury, and this jury happened to be outside of town in Riverside, which is very odd, a jury has said, you know what? This sounds fishy to us, and you owe the property rights, the intellectual property right creators money. You owe them money.
And that, I tell you, there's a lot of people with a lot of intellectual property that are looking at this case going, I wonder if, you know, the concept that I sold 12 years ago and ran for a long period of time, I can maybe get it on this now too. We'll get a little bit more into the accounting in Hollywood probably in the upcoming weeks, but this is something that has always been complained about unless you work within the entertainment system, because you seem to get overpaid once you're there. And obviously this is the reason, is because it kind of insulates you. It creates a nice bubble. And if this comes tumbling down where the accounting has to be there has to be responsibility for the accounting, because the other thing that happens, and I should mention this too, is the production company that actually makes the TV show eventually just goes out of business. Once the show doesn't exist, they go, well, we're just fold. And so right. All of these separate dominoes, different parts of it can just go, you know, wither on the vine. And then who knows who owes who money? It's really bizarre.
Right. Well, Disney is going to fight this, and they're going to fight this as long as they possibly can. They are vigorously appealing this. They're saying that the original owners of the right of the idea have been paid millions of dollars, and we haven't been making the kind of money that they're saying they're making. But this is a case we're going to have to keep watching, because it's not getting a lot of press, but the ramifications of it are going to be interesting. And it kind of takes us to our next story, which goes more online, because there is a weird thing going on with the internet where you don't know who owns the rights and who is responsible for making sure that everyone gets paid for their own property. And what has happened with Google or Viacom and YouTube is kind of fascinating. To try to explain it, Mike, because basically it's good news for people who like YouTube. It's bad news for anybody who's got their own property that's getting stolen.
Well, yeah. It's also, you know, I think that the Viacom lawsuit, and I'll try to break it down again pretty simply here, is basically Viacom as a company owns three things that are very popularly put onto YouTube by just normal people. And that is South Park, clips from The Daily Show, and clips from The Colbert Report. And they kept on, they were complaining ad nauseum. And I'm really wondering if this was, I'm thinking this started even before YouTube was bought by Google, but obviously things have changed corporately. But they were complaining that basically YouTube was making money off of their property. And YouTube's argument back was, the minute you tell us that that property is up there, we will make sure it's taken down. And that was formally the foundation for this lawsuit. And basically the court said, listen, they're being responsible in taking everything down. They don't owe you any money. Of course, this also puts the onus on the copyright holder to notify YouTube or any other video sharing format, I guess, or whatever, posting type of format, that they have been infringed upon. So basically, you got to know that you've been stolen from to contact them to tell them to take it down.
And contacting them is not as easier said than done. Basically, you need an attorney who knows what he or she is doing to contact YouTube. And they have to contact them for every single infringement. And who can keep up with it? If after an episode of whatever, 5,000 people put it up in 10-minute chunks, how are you supposed to go there and complain 5,000 times?
Now, it is interesting, though, that there has been obviously, this has been a long-term lawsuit. And Viacom actually figured out something within a short period of time, which was, you know what? We got to build a very robust website for these properties and make it so that we control the content. Because and be able to license it to who they want to license it to. And they've done a very good job of creating chunks that you could put on Facebook and stuff like that. But it always comes from their source. And I think they've been very smart in being able to come up with that model. Now, do they make much money on it? I don't know. Advertising and all that kind of stuff, it's tough. Obviously, social networking has its own, it's almost as if it is advertising when it's there. So we got to see where these things land. But, you know, I think that Viacom has learned over the course of time. And I think that YouTube, you know, obviously they haven't learned that much because they kind of got away with this. But I would say at least, at least they're taking the stuff down. They're not trying to fight this. So,
right. But it's great because this kind of transitions to our last story for today, which is Hulu. You know, we were talking about a year ago, talking about different companies that we wanted you to keep an eye on. One was Boxy, but Hulu has done something interesting, something that I thought they should have done a little while ago, but it's going to probably alter what happens with YouTube, and that is they've unveiled a new subscription service, Hulu Plus, where basically for $10 a month, you will get access to full libraries of programs. You know, Hulu's been giving you a lot of free stuff, and of course you can find a lot of free stuff on YouTube. But as we've learned with iTunes, people will pay a small fee for unlimited access, immediate unlimited access to huge catalogs. And I think this is actually really good for intellectual property, because now maybe people won't post so much stuff, or people won't go for it at YouTube when they realize they can get a full episode or all the episodes of, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer on Hulu Plus.
Yeah, I think that this is a pretty smart thing, because it gives people the option to delve deeper. And if you're like a super fan or whatever, that's a huge thing. If you're a big TV junkie, and this also, you know, in a lot of ways, it makes an interesting thing for syndication, because it lowers that value. But if you're a big fan of 30 Rock, you know, there's a couple of episodes that are up on NBC.com. There's a couple of episodes, you know, at the regular Hulu thing. But now, if you're going to pay the $10 a month, you've got every single episode. And this is going to grow bigger and bigger. I think that it's good that Hulu's getting into this game. I think they have three out of the four major networks on board. I think CBS is going to try to do something on their own. And CBS also owns the website TV.com. So they're trying to just create their own library themselves. And it's interesting. If you go to, alternatively, instead of Hulu.com, to TV.com, TV.com has got some interesting old libraries there for free as well. Obviously, now Hulu says, well, you know what? If we're going to have to pay for having this access, we might as well start charging. The advertising model, I don't know where that goes. But
this is, you know, this is what I've been waiting for a long time. I can remember 10, 12 years ago, we would say to people, you know, someday every show will be available on demand. It'll just be there. And, you know, how amazing it will be. And it's been very slow coming. But this is a big step toward that. And I really think, as these things get consolidated, if you don't have to pay too much of a monthly fee, it's always if the price point is right, that people will pay it to get unlimited access. They'll do it. People are not completely opposed to paying for content. It's just that you can't be too arrogant about it in this world anymore. You know, we didn't even talk about how Prince has decided the internet is dead and he's taking off. I think it's because no one is going to his website anymore. But the internet is not dead. It's alive and well. And instead of being arrogant about it, simply say, hey, a song is 99 cents. Or here's all the TV shows you ever wanted for $10 a month. If the number is right, people will still pay
Absolutely.
For it.
Absolutely. And I think you're right that really what's going to be figured out here is the price point. I got to admit that I not only pay for satellite radio, but I also pay for internet radio. I pay for Pandora and Sirius. And it's just the fact that once those price points seem to be perfect for me. I didn't want to deal with commercials and 40 hours limited a month with my internet radio. So I just, you know, forked up $30 for the year, which seemed to be perfectly great. And I think that Hulu, I don't know if this is the price point. Maybe it's $7.99. Maybe it's $15.99. Who knows? But I think that this is a great way of giving that TV junkie his fix at a decent price. And also, you know, doesn't keep you completely stuck to TV land. You have some control over what you get to see.
Right. So we're going to be paying attention to Hulu, and believe me, Hulu will be leading this pack, but they will not be the only ones. Mike mentioned CBS, but there'll be other offshoots of this. This is going to really change the way you get content. So we're going to keep paying attention to this. We're going to start looking at all the movies coming up toward the end of the summer, and then we'll be heading off to the fall and the Oscar time. I know, I can't believe it's already around the corner. We'll be looking at some of the upcoming shows for the fall and the end of the shows for the summer. And we'll be checking out all stories in the business entertainment world next week. So for Mike Patterson, I'm Jeff Bob. Have a great day.